SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two. 10 minutes in on Tuesday, still enjoying the afterglow of Travers Day, or in the case of Jeff Bloom and his contingent, Personal Ensign Day. Right? It's not right, Jeff, that, you know, for everybody else that participated in the other big grade ones, they call it Travers Day, but it was Personal Ensign Day for you. Good morning.
Yeah, we're still enjoying the after effects, and that kind of thing just does not get old, Steve.
Well, not when you have a filly that just is basically cutting a wide swath through the country because she doesn't need anything, any kind of racetrack. Wherever she turns up, she just performs. And, you know, we talked on TV Sunday. It's why one of the reasons I thought to have you on, we talked to Steve Asmussen last week, and, you know, we were kind of anticipating, you know, what was going to transpire. But if ever there was a setup where, you know, you had the potential for a built-in excuse, it was the way that race looked on paper, that Elate had every advantage, and yet Mike Smith was able to offset it with the help of the filly.
Well, I like the way Steve described it following the race in one of the interviews, where he said a lot of check boxes were taken care of there. Look, we personally, internally, felt that we had the best horse going in. We didn't believe that the distance was an issue in any way, shape, or form. You and I have talked about that, where, yes, others look at it like, well, she's undefeated at a mile and a 16th. But again, it wasn't like she had run many races outside of that distance. So we were very much looking forward to being able to answer a lot of those questions, running over the Saratoga track where she didn't have her best races last year, having to give up weight. So it really was a big, enormous relief to be able to say we took it down. We answered even more questions. And Steve and I were talking earlier this morning, just marveling at just the filly is just so remarkable. And then to wrap it all up, the beauty of it is just she's so elegant and pretty and charming. You know, she's this fierce competitor, and then you're around her at the barn, and she has this striking elegance about her where she just catches your eye if you're walking by. And so, again, it's just an amazing ride that you just don't ever want to end.
Well, and you got ways to go yet. Let's talk the immediate portion of this. And when Steve references, you know, checking off boxes, you know, one of them was the distance. You know, there was the trope going on into Saturday that, well, she's the better filly at a mile and a 16th. You know, and I can imagine when you've accomplished what you've accomplished with this horse, you know, 11 for 17, never off the board. You hear that stuff, and you you see it on the internet, and you hear it on TVG or on, you know, the commentary, the various places that these things are discussed, and you have to bristle, right? I mean, it has to kind of hit your ear like a sour note.
Yeah, you pay attention to what you pay attention to, and look, the beauty of our game is there are numerous people with opinions, and those opinions aren't necessarily on the same page. So that's one of the great things about our wonderful sport of horse racing. But yes, we know what we know about the filly, and she continues to just impress us even that much more. And really, she's actually improving. I mean, she bounced out of that race. She had every right to be, exhausted, hunkered down, kind of out of it a little bit. You know, she had to lay her body down. And look, let's not take anything away from Elate and her team. I mean, Elate's a phenomenal racehorse. She's just a beautiful, exceptional racehorse. And so it makes it even that much more special to be able to say we won that race. And the fact that Midnight Bizou has been sparkling since coming out of it, she's just in rarefied air right now. And it just continues to move forward that way, which makes it that much more intriguing and exciting as we approach the end of the season.
The way things unfolded, talk about what you were watching and, you know, what you were hoping for, what was going right, what was, you know, initially potentially alarming, and, you know, how cognizant were you at that point of on the day about the inside? And was there any discussion that, you know, the inside, which has been not the best place to be all meet, really, that, you know, did that come up much with Mike and with Scott and Steve? You know, what was the game plan?
Yeah, so I will say, for whatever reason, Steve, I had just an additional level of anxiousness and nervousness coming into this race. And I think some of it too was just, we wanted to answer some more of those questions. And it was a pretty big stage to be doing that at Saratoga, such an important race. So I tried to hide those emotions and that nervousness from everybody, because my job is just to not get in the way. And so, like, some of the track bias and some of the discussion or strategy around how the complexion of the race should unfold and all that, the beauty of that situation, Steve, is you're talking about the barn of Steve Asmussen and his team, and in a rider who is unparalleled in terms of strategy, skill sets, knowledge, all that stuff, and familiarity with our filly. So it wasn't like there was a lot of discussion between all of us in terms of this is how and what you need to do. And certainly those of us involved were very aware of how the track was playing and who was in our race. But at the end of the day, you're giving a leg up to Mike Smith. He knows what to do. He's going to do what he should do. And he's going to be able to adjust should things look different than you expect them to look. The way the race unfolded, I thought maybe there'd be a little bit more pressure on the front end with Coach Rocks than there was. But in being able to see my filly and watch, you know, I'm so familiar with watching Mike and how he sits on our filly, I felt pretty confident that he was locked and loaded and that was just getting ready to wind up when he thought he should. Part of the concern was you could see the same thing in Jose Ortiz and Elate. And so it was whether or not that other filly getting first run on us was going to be too much to overcome. But with the fact that our filly has just continued to get stronger and improve, I thought we were going to, when we got to her, we were going to go by a little bit quicker than we did. But at the same time, that other filly was not giving up. I knew we had momentum. I just didn't know if the wire was going to be in our favor or not. And as it turned out, it worked out.
Where were you from an angle to see the finish live? I mean, I know that, you know, some people, depending on where they are and some of these, you know, some of the tight finishes. Like, for instance, we talked to Greg Sacco yesterday, and Greg was a little further past the wire, so he wasn't sure initially if mind control had gotten up. But where were you, and when did you know you won?
I was on the second floor in the boxes, just on, or just, if you will, off the wire. I tend to be quite mobile when the race is going on. I feel part of my job is to help the rider, you know, down the stretch. And so I was... I was on quite a lean as they were coming to the wire. When they hit the wire, I was just, I would say, a tick north maybe of when they crossed the wire. And I'm usually pretty good, Steve, with gauging the nose or the head bob on the wire. And I felt very confident that we got it watching it live. And all those around me were saying, you know, congratulations, you got it. And then when the replays started coming up, I was like, man, I'm not sure. So it was an eternity making that walk down to the track and waiting down there. You know, it's hard to explain or describe when you're waiting out a photo that's too close to call like that, when it can go either way, and you know, you're one step from either side of being extreme jubilation or frustration. And so I have to say I was quite pleased when they posted our number.
Yeah, and she, when you watch the replay a few times, and it even felt this way live, that once she actually got her nose and shoulder in front, that they basically stayed that way for the last several strides, and that, you know, it was evident that Elate was just not going to, you know, there wasn't any extra thrust coming, you know, from her, and that Midnight Bisou, you know, had her measure at that point, and it extends the seasonal streak. I wasn't sure when I said earlier if it was six or seven, but it's six, and it's just you know, such an enviable campaign at this point. There's more to do, though. You know, this is one of the challenges when you're at this level, and that's keeping it going and finishing out the string, and you know, getting back to the distaff and another chance in the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, you know, and so of course, when we started the campaign early in the year in January, it was about, well, let's get her started, but you know, we're focused on taking down the Breeders' Cup this year, and how do we get there? And you know, you blink, and all of a sudden, here we are in the second half of the season, and so far so good, but we still have some work to do, and of course, we're very focused on that, and excited about what might play out here the remainder of the year.
Give us a feel. You know, there are a couple of different options to, you know, you're going to stay up here. In fact, we discussed this over the last several summers and into the early fall. The Asmussen barn has gotten into a very steady routine, which includes Scott Blasey, you know, basically keeping the stars, a number of the stars, up here at Saratoga, and you know, then getting ready for their final tune-ups toward Breeders' Cup, and that seems to be your agenda.
Well, the key there, it's an easy way for Scott to be able to get into some of those tough-to-get-in restaurants when the meet ends. So it's a good excuse for him to stay late at Saratoga. But yes, it's worked out well for Steve and the crew in the past, and that's what we'll do this year with Midnight Bisou. So she'll continue to stay in her same spot and train right up to the Beldame, which will be run, of course, as you know, at Belmont Park. So it's kind of an easy, it's really a nice transitional travel situation for her to be able to slide down for a couple hours to Belmont, get that race in, and then from there the plan would be to immediately ship out west to California at Santa Anita, where she'll have an opportunity to get fully acclimated and basically create a situation where she's running out of her own stall, if you will, for the Breeders' Cup, which we really want to be able to do. She's an exceptional traveling horse. As you know, if you look at her resume, she's run all over the place. She shows up for every dance. And we just figured let's make it as easy as possible for her and let her get settled in and be able to run right out of her own stall.
Well, and even though there's been undoubtedly a ton of track maintenance at Santa Anita, you know, for those that forget, it's where she started her career, essentially. And in the days with Bill Spahr, where, you know, she broke her maiden. I think people forget that she broke her maiden in the stake, right, in the Santa Inez.
Yeah, she actually broke her maiden in a grade two.
Well, and that, in fact, let me dig down into beyond the page.
So her first two starts, if you recall, her first start was at Santa Anita, and she just missed running against Dreams Tree. And she ran so well that at that point, one of the best options was at Del Mar in the Desi Arnaz Stakes, and of course she had a matchup again with Dream Tree, and we had a real rough start, really lost all chance at the start and still just missed by a nose in that race. And so at that point, it made a lot of sense to come back, you know, in a spot where Zizichi was a winner already coming into the Santa Ynez, and she opened up a lot of eyes at that point.
And then followed it up with the Santa Isabel, and then, of course, the first grade one opportunity, which I was out there for that, wins the Santa Anita Oaks behind Monomoy Girl and Wonder Godot in the Kentucky Oaks. The Mother Goose, and onward, she's gone. I mean, the fact that she's never been off the board in her career is just amazing. And then this string this year, which now features three grade one wins, the Apple Blossom, the Phipps, and now the Personal Ensign. And, you know, all of this, we should note, because I'm going to bring it up, and I'm also going to fold in Henley's Joy as well. You know, this year's nice success story. Both OBS April purchases, Jeff, and I want you to talk about, and both modestly priced purchases, I want you to talk about your approach. You know, you've had a series of successful conversions. Snapper Sinclair folds in and so forth. But talk a little bit about, you know, the acquisition, the identification of prospects, the preference. You know, you're doing a little of everything in terms of yearling and weanling and breeding and so forth. But talk about the two-year-old in training sales approach, budget and identification, and, you know, then, you know, turning them into these kinds of stories.
Sure. So, as you mentioned, we do both buy and sell, essentially at all the levels. So we pinhook weanling to yearling to two-year-old, but we also purchase horses primarily for race at both the yearling and two-year-old sales, although sometimes purchasing as weanlings as well. But at the two-year-old sales, which I really enjoy a lot, and for the most part, where I cut my teeth, so to speak, in terms of being a bloodstock agent and acquiring horses, the huge edge or advantage at a two-year-old sale is the fact that you actually get to see a horse move, which really is a huge difference in terms of just, one, evaluating horses' conformation makeup, their physical attributes. But when you can actually see how a horse moves, what their stride looks like, how they react to the actual process of going through a sale, so much of what makes a good racehorse is mental, those mental adjustments and the internal part of it, which is their game and heart. And because those are things you can't train. And so for me, you know, it's like I get asked all the time, well, why'd you buy this horse? Why that horse? Why didn't somebody else buy it? We all have different ways of looking at things. I have a methodology that I've developed over numerous years that combines the technical aspects of it, which is the stuff that you can teach somebody about. You can teach somebody to understand or look at, you know, how a horse is put together, whether they're back at a knee, whether they toe out, whether they're sickle hock, or those things that are easy to identify. The other part are the intangibles and understanding what goes into what a horse's presence is, what their eye looks like, what your gut tells you. And so for me, when I'm at a two-year-old, I'm spending a lot of time before, during, and after the horse goes through their preview or their showcase. And what I mean by that, for those listening who aren't aware of it, horses showcase their talents by breezing either an eighth of a mile or a quarter of a mile, and you time the horses and you check their gallop out. So for the horses I select, it's a whole list of various checklist items that really have to match up. And then the problem is now everybody has a budget. And for me, we're always looking for value. And over the years, we've done well identifying value plays, horses that, you know, it's all relative, but that we still were buying at bargain basement prices. You know, sometimes you have to pay more than you expect. And certainly in recent years, we've had to bump up the percentage of float relative to what we pay for a horse. But we've been very fortunate over the years in terms of acquiring horses at very fair prices. And I think I mentioned this to you the other day. When I went into the ring to bid on Midnight Bizu, there were two horses at that particular sale that I had to have. One was Snapper Sinclair and one was Midnight Bizu. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to get either of them, especially Midnight. When the hammer dropped for what it did, I was just overjoyed. It wasn't one of those things, oh, shoot, why didn't anybody else like her? It was more, I can't believe I got her for this. And when I go into the ring, if I decide I want one, I'm thrilled at the lowest price I can get, because once I've made my decision, you have to stick with it, and I'm confident in the choice I've made at that point.
There's a couple of things about her history too that is pretty astounding, and not the least of which is, if we go back to Keeneland, and here we are on the doorstep of the September sale, you go back to Keeneland 16 when she was a yearling, she was in the last book.
Right.
Book.
Yeah. And there's, look, so there's only so many horses that can be in book two and in book three and book four. And as a seller, I've had that happen to me where I have a horse that I'm very high on. Unfortunately, it got placed in a later book. You have less active buyers. But we've seen it time and time again. Really good horses come out of any book. Sometimes, for whatever reason, they get placed in a spot that isn't going to be conducive to a big sale. And so, as you mentioned, Midnight Bizu R&A'd, didn't meet her reserve at the Keeneland sale. The owners, which was Woodford, they both bred and sold and trained leading up to the sale, they liked the filly. They felt she was worth more than that, and probably felt she was worth a lot more than that when I bought her at the 2-year-old sale. But that happens all the time. That's the great thing about this game. You know, it's good horses come from anywhere.
Well, she fetched $80,000, and what did she breeze in the April sale in 17?
That's a fair question. I want to say she went down there in 10-1, and I should remember that right off the top, shouldn't I? I want to say she hit a 10-1 or a 10-2. I'm gonna have to look that up, Steve.
Well, I'm doing the same thing actually, and
I'll let you look it up.
I'm doing the exact same thing. April of the 17th sale, and you know,
right.
this brings up a couple of topics. And we've bought horses the last 2 years at OBS. Having to observe them over the synthetic surface and knowing that what they're doing on that surface is not necessarily representative of what your expectation for them is. You know, particularly this is a filly that was by Midnight Loot and out of a repent mare. There was every expectation that she was a dirt horse. And so you're having to translate what you're seeing in the action. And, you know, you can't worry about the 10-1, the 10-2, the 10-3. And that's what makes, you know, to me, these sales, and particularly the training sales, as opposed to the yearling market or even the weanling market, where you're just looking at physical and maybe a walk, you're looking at a horse's action and then, you know, translating it into, you know, what you anticipate as they mature. And that's, you know, that's a talent. That's, you know, that comes from, you know, observing, and you as an exercise rider and a jockey, you know, understanding, you know, the way a horse is going. I mean, talk about that equation, looking at a horse over synthetic and understanding how it's going to translate on dirt.
Yeah, one of the toughest things that you alluded to is the fact that it's a synthetic surface. That synthetic surface helps a lot of horses out. And if you look at the breeze show over the course of the number of days that they have it, you're going to see a lot of similar times. Big, big differences between horses that are going down there. You'll have 25 horses that can go down there in 10-2 or say 10-1, but there's an enormous difference between 24 of them. So, part of it is just, you know, putting in the hours and understanding and being around so many of these horses, training, racing, and prepping on the various surfaces and understanding the mechanics of how horses move. And really one of the trickiest parts, again, to go back to what you said, is extrapolating or understanding how to transfer that horse's physical attributes, their motion, their stride, as it relates to getting over the synthetic compared to the dirt. And like I said, it's a lot easier. The dirt surfaces for the two-year-old auctions is a huge differentiator. It's a big separator in terms of horses that don't move really well won't look really good on the dirt compared to horses that don't move very well can, in fact, look very good moving over the synthetic, and they can also go much faster oftentimes. So for me, time is important to some degree. They have to be able to go fast enough, but some of the best horses I've purchased were nowhere near the bullet works of the preview. And also, one of the things to remember is, and it's kind of sort of contradictory, most everybody's looking to get that classic distance horse, yet they want to identify with the horse that's going the fastest at the preview. These horses are never, ever going to have to go an eighth of a mile in 9.4, 10 flat in their lives again. As long as they have enough internal speed, you know, that 9.4 compared to 10.3 is somewhat irrelevant to some degree, you know, as you start looking at horses that you're going to stretch out to two turns. So it is a little bit tricky, and it's not something that could be answered in one conversation, but it's all of those things that you're looking for. And so, as you said, it's a big difference between breezing over a synthetic surface as it is over a dirt.
Well, and she went in 10-1, and I'm putting it up right now on right on Twitter for people. They can watch the breeze, and you can decide for yourself if you liked what you saw well enough to to outbid Jeff, who signed the ticket for $80,000, and you could have gone. You say to yourself, "Oh my God, I spent three times that for." You know, for a horse that, you know, that's now in the show ring, jumping over.
This is a crazy business we're in. You know, and so her preview, and of course I've gone back and watched it multiple times. And for me, you know, I'm taking tons of notes, you know, as we're going through the process. And then, you know, I'm going back and evaluating the horse by itself, going back and watching the video. But the most important thing for me as a buyer is I have to be there live at the two-year-old sales. I have to see the horse prior to its breeze. I have to see the horse during its breeze. And I have to see the horse, more importantly, once it hits that wire, how it levels out, what its stride looks like, what the horse's motion, movement, fluidity is relative to getting through that initial eighth of a mile or whatever. And so it's all those components. The breeze that you see in the video is just one small piece. And if you watch her breeze, the reason she sold for $80,000 is because she wasn't obvious. She wasn't like, it wasn't one of those sizzling, eye-popping, like, wow, this is the one. Those are out there, but unfortunately they sell for $750,000 or $1 million.
Well, and it's funny you talk about leveling off, and that is a big part of what's appealing about this work. And I mean, certainly nothing wrong with going in 10-1, but the early part of the breeze, you know, she's kind of upright, and she almost even has a little turfy kind of high knee action. And then about midway in the stretch, she starts to level off and starts to really go. And, you know, the one thing about these breezes for those that buy remotely, you know, you bring up a great point about being on site. And when you're buying remotely, and you're looking at the breeze and you're evaluating pedigree and so forth, you don't see the gallop out. And the gallop out on these is really important. You also don't necessarily get the feel for how much, you know, sticking and hooting and hollering, you know, the riders. Did you ever, as part of your riding career, did you ever have to do some 2-year-old in training sale breezing?
Simple answer to that, I was way too scared. you got to be crazy person to do that. I did when I had my apprenticeship, right when I first got started, I used to qualify the quarter horses at Los Alamitos, which was a kick. But being a work rider for the breeze show with those babies, no, I wanted no part of that. I'll watch those to the sidelines.
Because there's a lot of motion. There's hand action. There's stick. They're really asking. You know, and sometimes you if you see a guy that isn't doing that, and the horse works nicely, that's encouraging too. I mean, that the horse doing it on their own more so than being motivated. Plus, a lot of times they're outfitted in every possible headgear and blinkers and, you know, anything well, you can imagine. How much of that evaluation do you do?
All of it. I'm taking notes on everything.
Yeah.
As well as, like, what rider's on the horse and what they're doing when they're on the horse. But it, you know, the riders can only do so much with the whip. They are not allowed to actually take out the horse. But there's there are things going on before and after. And look, these horses are babies, and they're being asked to go ridiculously fast with no experience. You know, 50% of them are still green, and 75% of them are slightly, and you know, to some degree, they don't know what they're doing out there. So there is all of that. It's for the sellers, it's their Kentucky Derby. They get one shot, and there might be some wind blowing, and a piece of paper goes in front of the horse right at the breakoff point. It throws its head. It loses a tick of a second. The difference on price paid for horses usually is pretty substantial, you know, from 9-4 to 10-flat and 10-flat to 10-1. I mean, there are some buyers who simply just take horses off their buy list, or the agents that take horses off their buy list if they're slower than a certain speed. So all of those things come into play. And if you're there live, as a lot of people are, you are able to witness every little bit of that because it's all of those things you were referring to.
Let's make the same exercise with Henley's Joy, because this is also a phenomenal success. A $20,000 yearling at Timonium Fall, and then comes back as an April 2-year-old for Gary Frommer, and you plucked Henley's Joy for $50,000.
Yeah, you know, I look back at that one, and I was very fortunate. Another horse that really should have gone, I thought, for more money. Like, you know, my objective is to identify the hidden gems, that things that people are missing. It's easy to go out there and buy the obvious. I mean, if I had buyers with that kind of budget, it'd be a lot of fun because you're going to get some good horses that have those attributes that display pretty obviously. So Henley's Joy, Kitten's Joy, I'm a fan of. I you know, recognize that there are value opportunities sometimes for some Kitten Joys at the 2-year-old sales. This was a horse that I thought he was a horse that presented enormous upside, and obviously, you know, you look like a genius after the fact, but I was pretty high on him, and he was another horse that I expected to sell for a bigger number than he did. But you know, he sort of fell through the cracks, and again, most of it was related to his preview just missed in a couple different ways. Which I love those kinds. Now, a lot of them miss in a couple different ways and you don't like them, but it's, the trick is noticing out of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of horses that are breezing, if you can identify something that was missed and yet that horse still has what it takes to be a good horse. And clearly Henley's Joy is exactly that. It's worked out really well for us.
A couple of notes. For starters, when you looked at him on a pedigree basis, it just so happened that you had an incomplete, more or less, because the damn Bluegrass Music, she had two foals and only one had made the races, so you didn't necessarily have a flashy page and a first dam that attracts attention and money. A lot of buyers like to have a handful of runners and a nice percentage, maybe six runners, four winners or five winners, that attracts buyers, number one. From a breeze standpoint, I'll say this about Henley's Joy: there's not a lot of wasted action. He's got a very smooth torso. His fuselage, it doesn't seem to me that he's wasting any motion in that video.
He's also, in addition to that, I felt that he was a horse that, evaluating physically, he had all the right pieces. And look, this is something, again, just I've been around horses my whole life, and I've seen all different types, from start to finish. He looked like he was going to grow up the right way, and that underlying ability that I felt was there was going to transfer into more of a powerhouse than what we were already seeing. And fortunately with Henley, and sometimes it doesn't work out this way, you're not always right, but it did. He immediately just flourished. He was a horse that we didn't have to stop on. We were able to go right on with him, and he just continued to impress from the get-go. And that's, if you recall, we tried him on the dirt, and the thought process there was there really wasn't any significant race on the turf that we were missing at that point on the calendar. And look, when you have a three-year-old that's exhibited talent, why wouldn't you go after the Triple Crown? And he had trained so well on the dirt. Like, all of his works had been on the dirt. And his last couple of workouts over the dirt were just really impressive. It's like, let's see if it transfers over. It didn't really pan out, although I would say that it was a weird surface that day anyways. Which keeps sort of sticking in the back of my mind. Look, we have an exceptional turf course, but at the same time, I just wonder if he would have had a more fair dirt course that day, would it have been a different performance by him?
Well, he had gone in 10-3, and for me, we bought two this spring and in June, and both had gone in 10-3, and I'm somebody that doesn't care what went on. I mean, if there's physical properties that are appealing, you're looking at a horse that's obviously a two-turn horse, who cares that they got it? It's the craziest equation to me, Jeff, that, people are like, it went 10-3. It didn't go fast enough. It's like, what are you talking about? This is a horse that might want every bit of a mile and a 16th, a mile and an eighth. What do you care that they didn't go 10 flat or 10-1?
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Steve. They have to be fast enough. But it's like I said before, and I hope people keep doing this. When people are buying for other people, it's hard to explain to their client that they're buying a horse that went three ticks or four ticks even slower than the majority of the horses. It doesn't compute.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
me,
yeah.
I look at every horse, and why did it go 10-3? And was 10-3 fast enough for what I want to do with this horse? It's funny, when I see one pre-breeze that I really like or that I think I'm going to like, I'm hoping they don't go fast. I'm hoping they go like 10-1 or 10-2, because when they go 9-4 or 10 flat, it's going to make it that much harder for me to buy that horse. And so it's easy to just chase the obvious. What we try to do is identify the hidden stuff. And Henley's Joy was a perfect example of that. I'm really proud of that horse, just in terms of, it's not obvious when you're buying those kind. And, things have to go right. We got very lucky, but that's sort of our program. That's what we focus on.
What about budgetary considerations, and how do you go in and what do you have as an overall, you go to OBS April and your expectation is to bring how many horses home for how much of a budget?
For the most part, we do some private work now where, I'll have, say, an order, if you will, for a client or whatever. But the reality is everything I do is at extreme value. When we go for our program to a sale, more often than not, and it's just us that's going in and taking the risk, we don't necessarily go in with a stated budget. We go in trying to find good racehorses, and then we evaluate what our budget should be. And it's really not necessarily maybe the best way, but that works for us. So, like, we may go to a sale, and I've done this, and spent a lot of time and money on, the time away, the vet work or whatever, and not buy a horse. And we've gone expecting to maybe buy one and picked up four. So it comes down to, I'm fortunate to be in the position now where we can go in, and if we want to buy, we'll buy, but we don't have to. In terms of what the overall budget is, it's not, oddly enough, necessarily defined prior to going to a sale. And look, we've spent out of our normal range in the past, but we're very careful about it. And at the end of the day, we recognize that it takes a lot to get a horse to the races. So the least we can pay for it, the better. It's not always easy, but you keep trying.
Well, when you've got the kind of horses for $80,000 when it comes to Midnight Bisou and $50,000 Henley's Joy, when you have them get the kind of results that that they've gotten this year and you know, so far in their careers, it's a great endorsement, obviously, Jeff. And what is next for Henley, by the way?
So Henley will ship, he's also still at Saratoga, he'll ship over to Belmont Park to run in the Jockey Club Derby, which I'm really excited about that, being that it's going a mile and a half, and we know he likes being over there at Belmont, so that'll be not this weekend, but next.
Well, and the third leg after having won the Belmont Derby, you know, coming back to Belmont, the opportunity to split decisions, I suppose, with Kieran will be back certainly. And when it came to assignments with the variety of trainers, because it is interesting that, you know, a horse like this, that it was very much a you know, ultimately you had to feel that Henley's Joy, that his most likely future was going to be on grass, you know, to go to a mic maker who is so proficient on that front. What's your decision making process on trainer assignments?
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, I get asked that. It's not an exact science. My two, Steve Asmussen has the majority of our horses and turf horses. You know, it's like riders sometimes get tagged being a speed rider or a turf rider. You know, both Mike Maker and Steve Asmussen are exceptional trainers. I try to have some diversification just to spread things out a little bit. And clearly Mike has had endless numbers of Kitten's Joys, in his portfolio. So it wasn't like that was a tricky decision there. Not that the horse, you know, could be doing just as well, you know, say in Steve's barn, but it was just in the moment, well, this makes a lot of sense. You know, we'll send this one over to Mike and get him going there. We have good programs working in both of those situations. And it's not like one or the other can only train this type of horse. It doesn't really come down to that in any way, shape, or form. It's more just, kind of a geography thing and a timing thing.
Well, everything that you've been doing is working well. I mean, not every single purchase and every, candidate pans out to the extent that these two are and Snapper and so forth, but an outstanding strike rate, obviously, Jeff, and continued success. Who's the 2 year old? Give us the 2 year olds that have got you guys excited as the fall approaches.
We've got a few. Mike has a horse, a City Zip colt that we're really excited about by the name of East Lex. He's going to be getting to the track here in pretty short order. And then with Steve, I've got another City Zip by the name of Insta Famous. And that's a colt that just might be one of the best looking 2 year olds I have. And then also another colt by Street Boss by the name of Governale that we thought we'd have ready for Saratoga. But you know how that goes, little stoppages here and there. So he's just getting geared up too. So those are three that look like they might be horses to watch for in the coming season. So and then some others back back behind them as well. So we actually have quite a number of two-year-olds coming out, and then they're all just kind of getting ready to gear up right now. There's also, I forgot about Toma Toto, who's a horse that Mike Maker has, an English Channel colt that won first time out. He's a horse I think we paid, it was either 11 or 13,000 for, and he might be the best two-year-old in the bunch. So he's another one that we're expecting big things for.
Well, you can keep tabs on all of the Bloom runners, bloomracing.com, and Jeff so easily approached if you want to meet and talk about, you know, working and being involved and having Jeff pick horses out for you. He'll talk to you about that. And obviously a busy Keeneland sale period coming up, but it's been a wonderful summer, Jeff. You're back in California, and you'll obviously come back to New York as we get the Belmont Championship meet going. Congratulations to you and Steve and Scott and everybody involved. Bizu's win, and clearly it's going to be an exciting fall going forward.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Now, this was informative. I guarantee, and I'm about to send out that Henley's Joy video as well, so you can really get a physical understanding of what we just talked about with Jeff Bloom. And you can follow Jeff on Twitter as well under Bloom Racing or under JR Bloom 3 or both. You can comprehensive Jeff Bloom coverage. We're going to take a timeout. Top of the hour upon us. We've zipped through 2 hours already, and looking forward to Andy Serling and getting the comprehensive Andy Serling report on Trapper's Day. Andy joins us next, and then we'll close out the morning with John White in the bottom of the hour. Stay with us.